And I guess that's a good introduction for me. I'm going to give the talk today. I'm Mark Shattuck. I'm at the Benjamin Levitch Institute at City College of New York, and I work on granular materials. And just continue on.
Oh, yeah.
Or do you have any other thing?
That'd be great.
And so I'm going to talk today about some work that I've done with Corey and one of his students, Tenshi Shin. But the first part that I'm going to talk about are some experiments that I did with my student, Aileen Hubbard. So we tried to set up a very simple experiment. This is one of the things that Corey and I really like to do, is to try to take things down to the absolute minimum representative element of what can be seen. So here we have our granular packing of 7 particles. We have 4 small particles and 3 large particles. The aspect ratio is 1.25. These are actual experiments. These are actually washers, precision washers. They have very high...
This is two dimensions.
So we have a thin 2 glass plate separated by the thickness of the washers, essentially. And we can shake it up and down with this electromagnetic shaker. And here's an example. In this case, what's that? Gravity is downward. Mm-hmm. Gravity is downward. And in this case, this is not what we did most of the experiments with, but this is more for visualization. The experiments are done with steel, but these are photoelastic particles. And so what happens is when these things deform, they change the rotation of light. And so if you put it between cross polarizers, you can actually see the stress inside the material. And that's what we're seeing here. Those little bright spots are the stress showing up inside the material. So what we're doing here is we're creating packings. So we're creating packings. And so what happens is we throw the particles up in the air. So you'll see when the cycle starts. I'll wait for it to come around again. We're going to throw the particles up in the air. So it's just about done. Now it's going to start. We threw the particles up in the air, okay, and we let them settle to a particular state. Okay, and what we found is that we actually have a way to eliminate friction in these systems so we can actually make frictionless packings. And I'm not going to tell you about that story, but we made frictionless packings and we compared them with frictionless packings that you do in experiment and simulation, and they work out very, very well. So this is a really good model for frictionless packings. But the world isn't frictionless, and so we wanted to try to understand what's going on in friction as well. And so what we do then is we start out, and this packing is held up by friction. You can see that contact at the bottom would only be allowed if there was a tangential force. Let's wait for it to run one more time. Okay, so let's watch this guy. So this guy is only stabilized because there's frictional force, right? There's no way for it to be stabilized otherwise. But now you can see we can get rid of that friction. So we just got rid of it. We made the particles sort of slippery. And the way we did it was just by vibrating the system at a really high frequency, but a low amplitude. And so the particles just chatter. Of course, the frictional force is proportional to the normal force. So if you take the normal force away, then there's no friction force. So you can simply eliminate all the frictional force until you get down to a packing that can no longer relax. So here it is as a frictional state, and then we'll turn on the defrictioning, and it will just simply relax to a point. Now, you can see the particles are spinning, they have no friction, but there's no place else for it to go. So these frictional packings actually are stable at every stage. So we can actually do this in a stepwise fashion. Okay, so we can actually look at what's happening as we're going down in these states. So here's that initial state that I showed you before with this one particle that requires friction to be held up. And I can actually turn on the defrictioning for just a short amount of time. So I'll turn it on for 1 millisecond and then turn it off and wait and see what happens. Okay, so you gotta watch closely. Here's no taps, I've just let it sit here. 1 tap. Okay, so I turn it on for 1 millisecond, then I wait it. Now this state is also perfectly stable. It just sits there. It's also a perfectly stable state. So this is another frictional state. Okay, and this is one of the big differences between frictional states and frictionless states. Frictionless states exist as points in the phase space. There's only one spot where it can exist, and there's a finite number of them. For any finite system, there's only a finite number of these states. But for frictional states, that's not true. For frictional states, there's an infinite number of frictional states. Okay, but what we're going to show and what we found that was really interesting is that even though there's an infinite number, they come together as families. So we can still think of them as a countable set, but with an internal infinite degree of freedom. So that was 1 tap. Let's go back. So there's no taps, 1 tap. If I do it again, it continues to relax. Each of these states is perfectly stable. going along. This is stable, this is stable, this is stable, this is stable. But now I've done 10 taps and I've reached this state. Now at this point, friction is not holding this state up anymore. There's no more frictional context. So now I'm at one of these points, one of these frictionless state points. And you can see now I can tap 11 times, 12 times, nothing happens. 20 times, nothing happens. So I've reached the bottom, reached this point in phase space that represents the frictionless packing. Now, one way to represent these systems is by looking at their center of mass. So here's a plot of the center of mass of this, this system. Here's the y-coordinate and the x-coordinate. And now I'm going to look at it as a function of this in the center of mass space. I'm going to look at this tapping procedure. So here's the first state right up here. Here's the next state. You can see, of course, this is gravity. So of course, it's lowering. That's the force that we're putting on it. So it's center of mass is getting lower each time as we tap it. It goes down, 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 it goes down. And now it's reached this bottom point. And this bottom point represents a single point in the phase space. Okay, this has 7 particles, so there's a 14-dimensional phase space for this system. Okay, and this represents a point in that phase space. And this represents a line of frictional states that go along this. Now, what we noticed was that if you look at this line and compare it to all the other states that ended up at this point. So now I went, did this 250,000 times, and I looked at all these states. These are all the initial conditions that end up back at this exact same point. So this is my point for my frictionless state. And if I look at all of these states, these are all the ones that come back. And you can see there's this blue one that we were just following, but there's also a purple one. And you can see there's a green one that comes and attaches to it. So you can actually already see in this diagram that there's like a family of these states. And they exist on a smaller subset of the 14-dimensional space. This 14-dimensional space is being projected onto this 2D space. If it was just random in that space, then we would just see a random cloud here. Okay, but we don't. We see structures. That's telling us that there's an underlying, much lower dimensional space where these frictional states exist. And here is the set of all, yeah.
The last point is not frictional anymore.
This is frictionless. This last point, the point at the base of this.
There's no
friction left at that point.
It's not the state of lowest energy.
It's what?
It's not the state
of global lowest energy, but it is a local minima. And since these are really hard particles, we generally don't think in terms of energy, but in terms of density. It's the local densest state. Because these are really hard, so the energy really doesn't matter so much. But this local minimum in the local maximum, basically, in density is what represents this point. This is a unique state. In the sense that it's a single point there's nothing else around it. Okay, there's no other states nearby. And we actually showed this in an earlier paper, which I won't talk about today, but if you look at all the states, and I can sort of show it here, the bottoms of each of these families, you can see here's a family, here's a family, here's a family, here's a family. The one we were looking at, let's see if I can find it, it's right here, this one. That right there. That's the one we were looking at. Just a minute ago. Okay, and this is all the possible states. Turns out there's about 1,000 of these frictionless states. They're the base of each one of these families that we see. And those are all unique individual points in the phase space, up to the fact that there's permutations of the particles and symmetries, but otherwise they're the same. Yes?
I missed the point at the beginning.
That's right.
What is the equation of motion?
So the equation of motion is the real world. These are experiments. And so it's Newton's laws. Okay, so it's Newton's laws. Sorry.
Computer
yes.
Experiment.
Sorry. These are yeah. We try to make these things as close to experiments as possible, and so then as close to simulations as possible. So then people think it looks like the simulations. These look just like the simulations pictures, but this is actually experiments. Okay, so that's the laws. Those laws. Yes.
Okay. So does the picture depend at all on the tapping amplitude?
No. So it doesn't depend on the tapping amplitude. You follow along one of these things regardless of how small or large you make the tapping amplitude. Now, if you make it large enough, you might jump. Like, you know, you're here, maybe you would jump to a different one because you gave it too much of an excitement. But if we make them really, so you saw like there's, what, maybe 12 steps along the way. If we made the amplitude half as big, we'd see 24 steps, but along the same path. Yes?
I mean, if you made it too large, it just wouldn't come back to fun, right?
Yeah, so if we make it large enough that it's actually throwing the thing up, then it would be, yeah. But in this case, what I'm thinking of as large is I'm sort of fixing the defrictioning pulse, and I'm just changing the width of that defrictioning pulse. So the worst I can do is just defriction it uniformly, and it'll fall down this very rapidly. But when it's falling rapidly, then inertia can play a role, and it could move to another branch. But if you do it in this slow way, in this quasi-static way, then it always follows this exact same branch. So it turns out that there were 14 trajectories, actually, that follow this exact path that we saw there. Different times, just randomly out of the 250,000 times, that many ended up there. And this is then what we call these families. And like I say, there's bunches of these families, and here they all are. Yeah.
Are the descents deterministic? So in other words, could you find another initial configuration that goes down to a different final configuration, or?
So we're going to talk more about that. That's about, we'll see exactly how this works. So these are all the possible families then now. So even though frictional states are infinite, we have a way of sort of categorizing them based on their base here, based on the frictionless state, that they end up eventually going to. So let's look at this from another perspective, and this will get to some of what Craig is talking about, how these things actually occur. So let's look at it in terms of contact evolution, okay? And so what we really think of is that there's a set of little states, little families, that all are based on their contact, the exact set of contacts they have. So here's the original contact network. You can see there's one floater in this case. There's 12 total contacts that I'm showing, and as it evolves, I went to 12 again, so I had 12 here, but now I have a different 12, because you can see I made this contact. Okay, so I went from this contact to this contact. So I made a jump from this state to this one. Now I add an extra contact. Here I'm gonna add this contact, so I add that contact. Now I have 13 contacts. I keep going along this state. I'm keeping my same contact network this entire time. So this is like its own little family, okay, within this subfamily. Now I changed families, in a sense. I changed branches on this family. So each one of these is like a branch. So I have 13 contacts, and now I still have 13 contacts, but I made this contact and broke this one. So I have 13 again. Now I went back to 12, so I actually lost a contact. Let's see, this one on the wall, I lose that contact. So I lost
contacts
that.
To the wall, are they on equal footing to the contacts between the walls? That's probably a different material.
It is a slightly different material. The walls are a hard plastic, and the particles are actually steel. So there's a difference in the total force. But what we're thinking of here is that these things are all hard enough that the energy, the elastic energy in the particles and the wall, is totally irrelevant. And so, for example, we've also done the exact same thing with very soft particles. Those photoelastic ones I showed are very soft. You can just squish them with your fingers. And in that case, you get exactly the same thing. But there's a little bit, the points are a little more fuzzy because they get mushed a little bit from this. These lines are not as crisp if you use softer particles. So go to 12 and then back to 13. And now we get to 14. And 14 is the number you need for a frictionless state. Okay, to stabilize a frictionless state in this configuration with gravity, you have to have 14 contacts. And that's roughly how many you always have to have, 2 times the number of particles. That's roughly the number you need. You can just count the number that you need. You have a certain number of equations, you have a certain number of unknowns, then you can count how many contacts you need to stabilize the state. So this is the bottom. And so this is this contact evolution. What we think of is that each one of these changes is like a little branch on this family that starts down here at this frictionless state. And so now we can, I just said this, so isostatic, what we call isostatic, which means we have just the number of contacts we need to stabilize this without friction, is 14 for this case. And now what we can also look at is how far away are we from isostatic? Okay, so what branch are we on? So there's a labeling of each branch. So here we're at the zero branch, so we're at the isostatic point, we're at the frictionless state. We lose a contact, we go to something that's missing one contact, and then something that's missing two contacts, back to one, one, two, and so forth. And so these numbers are sort of telling us how far we are up the tree, and what sort of branch we're on each one of these trees. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. You're right, I did see 15. One of these must not be a contact. Let me see which one, hold on. This one. This one is not a contact. Sorry about that. I did this in haste. Should have used the computer. The computer knows exactly how many there are. This one is not, and the way I can tell is because there's not enough space on this bottom row. This bottom row is bigger than the sum of the diameters of each of these particles. So there has to be a space on that bottom row. So when I saw that there are one between each one of these, I know right away it's wrong.
Just maintain the reputation of this group.
Absolutely, please. Everyone, yes, counting is a definite plus in these things.
Your family is defined by just the value of the energy at the bottom, or?
So the family, the whole family, is connected to this guy at the bottom.
Because there could be degeneracy there. You could have different configurations with the same amount of energy, right?
You cannot have another state at this center of mass, no. There's no other state that has this specific configuration. This is a unique space. Up to permutations of the particles and symmetries. You can have a symmetric version of this. You can see from, I won't go back, but you can see from that big plot of all the states, it's actually symmetric because there's going this way. But these are unique states. Okay, you can define the phrase. And we actually measured in a previous study the distance between unique states. And it's always about a particle diameter in phase space. So if you do the 14-dimensional distance, it's always about d. All the particles are always about d away from each other. So these are unique states. Okay, so now what we can think of then is that, as I was just mentioning, this state is a zero-dimensional point in that phase space. That's why it's unique. There's only one thing there. It's just that one point. It's the only thing there. But then if I lose a contact, now I have a line where I could live. Okay, I have a contact, so I have a degree of freedom that I can adjust. And depending on the friction and how it got there, I'll be somewhere along this line. Okay, if I go and lose a second contact, now I have 2 degrees of freedom. Okay, there's 2 ways I can go. And so I have a two-dimensional surface that's part of this family. So you can see this family increases in dimension as I go further and further away. In this case, we never get lower than 12, so we only have two-dimensional surfaces that are part of this family. But other families do have three-dimensional, and that's the maximum for this case. For the case of 7 particles, that's the maximum you can have. Once you have less than that number of contacts, even friction can't stabilize you. So that's the highest you can go in this case. Okay. Now, what we can do to sort of analyze this and try to understand what's going on is we can try to treat this system like it was an actual spring network. So like it was an actual elastic network based on the contacts. Okay, so each spring network is a unique branch in this family, okay? And then we can treat this like it's a simple spring network. So here's the original case. Here's the springs that we have in the original case, okay? And these springs can then be measured, can be analyzed using a dynamical matrix. Okay, so we can look at this spring network, we can look at its dynamical matrix, and find out if it has any null space. Okay, and so in this case, this system has 2 missing contacts, and so the dynamical matrix has a 2-dimensional null space. That is to say, I can always solve this problem, I can always find a static solution without specifying 2 numbers. There's 2 degrees of freedom that live in the null space that I can adjust. And I've shown their eigenvectors here. So one of them was obvious, was easy to see. One of them is a floater. So this is the eigenvector associated with this. This guy can move back and forth along this line freely without changing anything in this system. The other one is much more complicated. It's this green set of arrows. So each one of these has to move in tandem with this ratio in order to make the spring network move without breaking any of the springs. Okay, and in this case, all the springs would be exactly stretched just the amount that they are when you start, and this is sort of how we are modeling this. And if we do that, if we take this spring network idea and we follow it, here the lines are from the spring network and the points are from the experiment that we found. So we just use this model of a spring network and we calculate it out, and this time we are doing a simulation. So the solid lines are a simulation of these each network. We're just following it along its eigen directions, and we just follow it along, and when it changes we follow that along, and when it changes we follow that along, and so forth until we get down to this final value. We follow it all the way until it stops. So when it gets down to zero, when it gets down to zero null space, when the null space dimension is zero, you can't go anywhere. So you're done. So you start up here. Along each path, you follow it until you can't go any further. So something will happen. A new contact will form, or a contact will have to break, one or the other. Yes?
But you're kinematically linearizing, so you're moving along the tangent director.
We're always moving along the direction of the null space. We're only moving in the direction of the null space. Okay. So.
But you're recomputing the new faulty modes each time you advance the, in the simulation, each time you advance the particle positions, you recompute the null space.
Correct. Yes. So each time we recompute the null space for the new, for the next trajectory. So it's not linear in that sense. We don't just start from here and try to shoot all the way from that original point. So we take a step.
You're really following the floppy manifold.
We're following the floppy manifold. And it's that floppy manifold, as you've said, that represents the family associated with the bottom of that, which is the point where there's no floppiness. Okay? Yes, so it's in principle, any direction could go, and that's why I was going to add one more thing. So the other piece that we do here is that we follow the null space in the direction of gravity. Okay, so that's the other piece. So we're only following the null space, okay, but then, yes?
What do you do with this single particle?
So that one, we follow the null space, we follow the projection of that eigenvalue in the direction of gravity. So the projection for this guy in the direction of gravity is zero. So it doesn't move. And that's what happens. It doesn't move because there's nothing pushing on it. So we just follow that in that direction. So that's what we do. So we start here, we follow in that direction. And so what we're doing is we're following these green arrows, but projected into the direction of gravity. So we take the null space, project it on gravity, we move in that direction one step, then we recompute, do it again, recompute, do it again, recompute, do it again. And what will happen is, as you remember from before, eventually at some point these two guys will touch. When these two guys touch, these guys stop touching, we change actual contact networks, and that is this shift to a new line, okay? And so we checked all of these families. They all follow this procedure. So we can compute all of the families just like this, every single one, using this idea of this spring network, okay? And so this was our sort of, how much time do I have? I sort of lost track because we're having such a good discussion. 10 minutes, okay, great. So I'm going to tell you, yes?
The moment where they touch, what happens to this
matrix? If what?
What happens to the matrix at the moment where they touch?
So at the moment when they touch, the matrix changes discontinuously. Okay, so you have a certain matrix element, so you'd have, you know, between each contact, you'll have a matrix element. Okay, so when this guy touches, this one goes away. Okay, and so you have this discontinuous jump in the matrix. And this is one of the things that makes these systems not smooth. I mean, what we're studying avalanches here and plasticity and things like that. This is one of the things that makes these things very not smooth. You can think of this like a plastic deformation, right? This is a plastic deformation under gravity, okay? And one of the things that makes it unsmooth is that this dynamical matrix is jumping from one thing to another. Now, this wouldn't happen if you had a long-range potential, right? If I had a long-range potential, all these guys are always in contact. They're always touching each other. You always have way more contacts than you need. But when you have a granular system where there's no long-range force, you get this discontinuous, completely discontinuous changing in the contact network and in the dynamical matrix. So this dynamical matrix just jumps to another branch of the same family. Okay, and so you get this very very sharp. You can see these very sharp changes essentially as it goes along.
So the force are continuous, but the derivative of the force is changing.
Everything is really continuous because if you're doing it at real gravity and so forth, then there is the elastic energy of the particle and so forth. So it does get smoothed out at some level on this. But in the model, it's totally, completely discontinuous. The force can also jump. Okay, so both can be completely discontinuous. Okay, in the model, that's not what happens in reality because we have things that smooth it, like the actual elastic energy and stuff like that. Okay, so now what we wanted to do with this motivation, that we have these families involved, we want to try to do some sort of theory or some computation involved in this. So now we're going to change to a different method of creating these structures because it's just easier on the computer and it's more homogeneous. It allows us to do a couple more things that we can't do under gravity and we can't do in the simulation. So what we're looking at now are isotropic compressions. Okay, so we just start by throwing particles down at random, and we just grow them until they can't grow anymore. Okay, no friction. And these are all the possible states you can get for a system of 6 particles, okay? There's 20-something states. 21? Okay, 21, I forgot. There's one state that has a floater, like we saw in the previous case, but most of them do not. And this is typical for small systems. There's only a small number of these systems, but it grows very rapidly. Of course, if we went to 7 particles, it'd be something like 200, and if we went to 8 particles, it'd be 2,000, and so forth. So it grows very rapidly. We want to try to just keep it in this small system so we can really understand what's going on. Now, the center of mass in periodic systems is not so obvious, not an obvious measure of how to follow these things. So we have that nice center of mass picture that we can look at. We want to do something else that's similar for these periodic systems. And so what we did was just look at 2 invariants of the system. One is the packing fraction, so that's one thing that we'll look at. So the volume of the that the particles take up, and the other is one of the invariants of the distance matrix. And so we just take the distance between all the particles, we find the eigenvalues, and we create this Q2, the second invariant of this matrix. The first invariant, the trace, is always 0, so we can't use that one. We could use any of these, it doesn't really matter which one we use. We just something that allows us to compress this 12-dimensional space onto a 2-dimensional plane so we can sort of look at it, so we can sort of see what's going on. And this represents the 20 states in this space. So this is the Q2, and this packing fraction represents all 20 states, 21 states? 20 states. All 20 states that are in this system. And now what we do is we add friction. Okay, so now we construct these same exact packings, but using friction. So we use a friction model, this Kundl-Strack friction model. And what you can see is now all these states form these families. So you can see these families again. The red points are still the ones we originally had. You can see these families that are coming out of each one. You can see these things look very similar to what we had in the case of the gravitational system. And again, just like in the gravitational system, we want to think about this as a spring network. Okay, so we have this spring network. But now the nice thing about the simulation is we can do something we can't do in the experiment. We can actually push on this spring network in any way we want. We have total control over how we push. And so how are we going to push? Well, we're going to push in a way that allows us to move along these families. Okay, so for example, we can take these two guys, which are originally in contact, and we can break that contact and we can start pushing. Okay, so we'll just start pushing. All the other contacts will remain springs. So all the others will be just like an elastic network, but we're going to push on this. So here's the first case, and then we moved here. Now, by using this spring model, we can actually enumerate essentially every member of the family that consists of this new contact network. And because there's 12 contacts here, there's 12 contacts we can pick. So there's 12 branches to the family that we move. And here are all 12 branches. Okay, so here's all 12 branches that you can get by taking this guy, breaking one of the contacts, and following it along. Okay. These are all the ones. And you can see the Kundl-Strack measurements also. What you see, one of the things that's interesting is that Kundl-Strack doesn't find some of these. Some of these are highly improbable, but they still live in there. And you can get them by doing certain things. Like if I'm shearing, maybe I'll be on a different branch that I don't get from compression. So I see that there's these differences. But if we go and look, all these states are stable Kundl-Strack states. We can go into the Kundl-Strack and find one of these states if we look for it. If we say we sit right there, we can find it and look for it. But some of them are very obvious, like this one just matches up on along with the Kundl-Strack states that we found. Okay, and we can do this same thing for more than one contact. Okay, so we talked about that there's lines and then planes, so we can also make planes. So now we have this guy that we're moving, but we could also pick another one and break it and go along a two-dimensional space. So we can move this one a little, move this one a little, move this one a little. We can move along a two-dimensional space. And here's what we have. So now here is this two-dimensional space that lives in the 12-dimensional space that we're projecting onto this two-dimensional plane. So now you can see it overlaps. They're not really overlapping. You know, when I go here and there's 3 places where I have the same state, it's not the same state because this is a 12-dimensional space. I'm just projecting it. So this is a two-dimensional object in a 12-dimensional space that's being projected back in 2D. So it looks like it overlaps, but in no place does it overlap. These are all unique in the same sense that this guy is unique. And what we did was we just followed 2 of these, so this one and this one. Okay, these are the 2 if we just do them individually, and then we would do this one a little bit and then follow this one along, and that's what gives us this entire plane. And If we then go in and measure the probability of having a certain number of missing contacts, so we call these things saddles. People call these things saddles. It's because there's, if you think about the dynamical matrix, there's some directions that are flat, okay, or that curve away. So there's certain directions that don't cost any energy or don't cost any density. And so if you are missing one contact, you have a first order saddle. If you are missing two contacts, you have a second order saddle. And if we go to a larger system, so if we go to a system with more particles, then we can see more and more of these saddles going. And that's what we've shown here. So here is a system of 30 particles, and we're looking at the probability that you'll get a particular saddle order. So if I have very, very low friction, it's very hard for me to make frictional states. So most of my states will be zeroth order. They'll be frictionless states. So that's the blue curve. So the blue curves are states that have zeroth saddle order. These are the points, the bottoms of these families, okay? Then the lines are the greens, okay? So these are lines. And then the red ones would be planes, and these would be three-dimensional objects, and four, and five, and so forth, all the way up. There's a total of 15 possible different saddle orders if you have 30 particles. Okay, so we have lots of these. And these points, the circles, are measurements from Kundelstrack. So we just create these states, and ask what the thing is. And these dotted lines are a theory that we've put together, okay, for predicting these states. And that theory is based on this simple idea that we've been trying to talk about here, that you have these zeroth order states are points, the first order states are lines, the second order states are surfaces. Okay, so here's this line in the second order state, here's the line from the first order state, and here's the point. So in the second order state, we can see all three. Here's the point, here's the line, and here's the state. Now, we can figure out how probable it is to live on one of these objects by looking again at the dynamical matrix of the spring network. It has, you can write it down as a simple equation where C are the connections and F are the forces that we're solving for, okay? And whenever this is zero, you have a solution. You have a mechanically stable solution, okay? And so you can look for solutions in the null space of C. And those solutions, then we can actually figure out then how probable it is for it to live on a certain part of this object. So for example, what I've sort of drawn in here is the probability that it will live in a certain place. So there's a low probability out here, it gets higher and higher and higher, and we can tell this from the size essentially of the null space, okay? And what we found is that if we sort of think of this, let me see what we have here, if we think of this as kind of a partition function, then this partition function we find that it scales linearly, it scales like a power law with mu, with the friction coefficient. And the power is the order of the saddle. So that is to say that for a zeroth order saddle, there's no dependence on friction, which is what we expect, right? No dependence on friction if you have no friction. If it's a first order saddle, then the volume of the phase space that they live in grows linearly with the friction. So the larger the friction I make, the more likely I am to be in that space. And as I get bigger and bigger, I do it linearly. If I go to a second order saddle, then I have two dimensions to live in, and that area then grows like the square of the friction. And I'm not going to go through all the details. Yes?
The metric is just the distance from each space.
The metric is volume. It's the volume on the subspace. And that's what allows us to do this. We're really looking, we're comparing volumes on a given subspace. So that's what allows us to do this.
The entropy is the logarithm of that?
Yeah, the entropy would then be the logarithm of this thing. Mm-hmm. Yes. And here we've actually measured it. So that this was a cartoon of the two-dimensional space and the probabilities that live on it. And here we've actually measured it. So here is in a subspace, a particular subspace, three-dimensional subspace, which is particle 1 and particle 2, particle 1's x and y positions, and particle 2's x position. So this is just one projection, so we can see this two-dimensional structure. And here it is, and then the color represents the probability that where we are living on that. And so we can then find the total probability for being in a second order saddle by just summing all these guys up. Oh, I'll just mention here, here's our measurements to show that this is true. There's no, not necessarily, and it's kind of, it's intuitive that this is true, but there's no necessary reason that it has to be true. So we had to check this, but here we've checked it for first order saddles and second order saddles, and we find that they both scale, like these power laws with the power that we expect. I'm not gonna talk about that today. So if we do sum up each one of those, we sum up the partition function for each saddle order, then these solid lines, these dashed lines are the lines we get. You can see they match up very, very well with what we get. So we just take this partition function that we made, we divide by the sum, and that gives us this probability as a function of mu of finding state M. So we just take that simple thing that we did there, and then it matches up very, very well. I'm not going to talk about this either, but there's a free constant in this that we have to figure out something to do with, and so we figured out something to do with it. If you're interested more, we can talk about that in detail. If we don't use the free constant, if we just set it to 1, we get the same sort of structure like you see here, but it doesn't match the experiment. But if we adjust this parameter, this one parameter, then we get something that matches very, very well. And that's talking more about that. And that's talking about this parameter that we mentioned. So now what can we do with this? And I'm still have another minute-ish. So what can we do with this? So now we can do things like we can take this probability function and find out what the probability of other things that depend on mu is. Like, for example, one of the things that people have been interested in is the average contact number as a function of mu. It shows this characteristic shape with a particular sort of cutoff, where at low friction you have 4 contacts, at high friction you have 3. Well, that's just counting, but how it goes between the two is not understood, and it can be understood now from this idea. So from this idea, if we sum up over the probabilities of having a particular mu, then we can actually find out the number of contacts, because each one is for M. M tells us the number of contacts, and that's what we've done. So this is for different system sizes. So the symbols are from Kundl-Strack, the lines are from the theory. And you can see for different system sizes, 16, 30, 64, 128, each one of these gets closer and closer to 4. At an infinite, it would be exactly 4. And so they all line up very, very close with what they have. How does it start? It's an asymptote out here. The behavior is that it's
correction.
That's a good question. I don't think we did an expansion of it, but I would guess it's linear out there, but I don't know. Have you?
I mean, I think it's 1 over n.
Yeah, it's probably 1 over n. You're probably right.
What is the unit of mu?
The unit of mu? The unit of mu is unitless. It's the friction coefficient. So it represents the ratio of the normal the tangential force to the friction force. To the normal force, sorry. So anyway, just to conclude then, what we have are these frictional families we found under these plastic deformations. The frictional states lie on a reduced dimensional manifolds in the full configuration space, so they're points or lines or areas. We can represent this by a partition function for each family. Okay, so each family has a partition function, and we can determine this function based on M with a simple theory, which allows us to predict all kinds of things, and we're working on predicting and doing other things. So thanks for your attention.
So maybe while we take questions, you already want to set up?
Yeah. I was just surprised that you rather than the algorithm was coming in. Should I think of this as multiplying the volume of the different cores of friction?
Yeah, you can sort of think about it like that. It's basically saying that if I'm living on a line, I'm sort of linearly, I'm proportional to the length of the line. If I'm living on a volume, I mean, I'm living on a plane, my probability is sort of proportional to the area. If I'm living on a cube, then I'm proportional to the volume. So if you have a small mu, I haven't really thought a lot about the small mu approximation, but I think that's a good thing to think about. I mean, it's easy to do. I mean, we have the formula for the partition function as a function of mu. We could easily It's a...
But I mean, it's, when view goes large, the other direction is large as well?
Yes.
So view is the, I mean, view is tangent, right?
So yes. That's right. Yes, for large mu. So on the large mu side, you're always stuck in the most dilute, the one with the fewest contacts.
Are you asking, do you think that the theory is worse for large mu compared to small mu?
Yeah, it is. Or perhaps that it should be mu but phi.
No, I don't think it's going to be phi, because phi is a free variable essentially in this. So we haven't said anything about phi. The thing is, that's where one of the issues is. Trying to predict phi.
Sorry, I don't need phi, the volume fraction, but the angular friction.
Oh, the angle of friction.
Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Well, right, yeah. So either way, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it may be more sensible to look at it in that variable to make that change.
So you said you had a one fitting parameter for value of m?
No, one fitting parameter.
For the whole
Marginal
function.
Yeah. So it turns out that what you'd expect is that it should go like there's 12 ways to go out if you have 12 contacts. Then you want to break a second one, there's 11. You want to break a third one, there's 10. So it should go like n choose m, right? That's what you should basically expect. So that's what we did first. We said it's just that. You just multiply the numbers that you have. And that's not quite right. It turns out that there's reasons why some of them towards either end basically are lost. I can talk about them with you later, but there's reasons why. So it turns out that the actual distribution is Gaussian. And we just have one fitting parameter for the Gaussian because the center is fixed. So is it that one parameter for that shows the fall off from this behavior that it should just be n choose m. If you have that's what you would expect it to be naively, but there's reasons to believe that it should be a little different in the middle than it is on the edges of n, so there's just the one function.
So what would it depend on?
So it depends on things like if I break one particular contact and let me tell it simple, that's our rule. Another one that it could depend on is there could be families that never get to the zero. So it could be lines that meet that never get to zero. So they don't have a connection directly back to the end. Those things we're not counting because we always start from the base. So there's those, and you should expect there to be more of them in the middle and less of them at either end.
So. All right, well, let's thank him again for a great talk.